Do I have to welcome everyone again? Well, welcome. Happy. So my first contact with Buddhism was through the Zen tradition, and I did many years of Zen practice. First at the San Francisco Zen Center and at Tassajara, some of you might have been, and then I was ordained as a Zen priest at the Zen Center, and then I went to Japan and practiced in Japan for a year. And during that year in Japan, I spent 10 weeks in Thailand, where I was introduced to this particular form of Buddhist meditation that is called mindfulness practice in its most generic form. And the Buddhist word for it is vipassana, which is often translated as insight meditation. And I fell in love with this particular form of meditation during those 10 weeks in Thailand. And partly because the mindfulness practice in Thailand seemed to me a much more, had the tools, or gave me the techniques or methods or the understanding to help me bring a mindfulness practice, to bring in a practice of attention to all aspects of my life. And it wasn't so much certain aspects, it wasn't just about concentrating on one particular area of my life, but my full humanity was included within the spiritual practice. And that's what I was looking for. I was looking for a spiritual practice that didn't deny any part of me, didn't exclude any of it, saying this is unacceptable as a spiritual dimension of my life, but actually could infuse or apply everything, apply the spirituality to all areas of my life, or apply all areas of my life to my spirituality, maybe is a better way of saying it. So I really loved the mindfulness practice, and so then I went back to Southeast Asia and spent a year and a half training and studying in the Southeast Asian Buddhist tradition of and doing the mindfulness practice there. And I came back to this country in mid-80s and continued some practice here. And then in the late 80s, I was trained, and in the early 90s, trained by Jack Kornfield to be a Vipassana teacher. And then in 1990, I became the teacher here in Palo Alto. There was a small sitting group in Palo Alto that met. And when I joined it, there were about 12 people, 15 people who sat regularly. And then since then, we've slowly grown. And now our main meeting is on Mondays, and there's often 80 to 100 people who come. So I'm a Zen teacher. I'm also a mindfulness teacher, what I'm doing here, a Vipassana teacher. And I'm also, I don't know if it gives me more qualifications or less qualifications to teach you meditation, but I'm also a doctoral candidate in Buddhist studies at Stanford. And so I'm just finishing up there my dissertation. So that's my background. And I'm very delighted to see all of you here today. It's something I love doing. The mindfulness practice I'll be teaching you is something which I love very much. And it's actually a privilege and delight to be able to share it with other people, to share what I love. So I hope that some of my inspiration and joy in what this practice is contagious, you know, or somehow is conveyed during these 5 weeks. So these 5 weeks will be spent giving the instructions for mindfulness practice systematically, kind of building 1 week to the next. And we could give the instructions for mindfulness very quickly. And traditionally in Southeast Asia, it's often given in half an hour. When I first came to a meditation retreat in Burma, I showed up for instructions, and they gave me a cassette tape and a cassette player and said, go listen to this by yourself. And it had the instructions that in half an hour I listened to this tape and got the instructions, and off I went to my little room where I was supposed to practice in the monastery. And so it can be done that way, but I think, you know, maybe hearing it, you know, personally and orally is a little bit more useful. And what we found in America, it seems very useful to build the instructions progressively over several weeks, so that we get something very simple the first week, and we'll talk about the breath primarily, and then we build on that the next week, and then the second week we'll talk about the body, physical experiences, and then you have a chance to go home and practice with that, And then we build on that experience to give the instructions for emotions and how to include emotions as part of the practice. Then you go home, you get a chance to practice with that. And then the next week, the fourth week, we talk about thoughts and our cognitive life. And with all that as a foundation, then the last week we'll talk about how to integrate the practice, apply the practice into our daily life. So it seems to work very well to have that kind of sequence and do it gradually. And that's what we'll do. If you miss one of the classes for some reason, Allison here, we've tape recorded, we'll tape record this session, but also we've done previous classes series, and she has them available. You can buy them from her. So if you're going to miss one of the classes, you tell her which class you're missing, and you can get what? Yeah, she doesn't have any with you, with her, so you have to kind of order them from her. And so, like, if you're going to miss next week, which is on the body, you ask her for the body tape, or the second week tape. And it varies a little bit, you know, from class to class what I say. I don't have, like, a script, right? But it's basically, instructions is basically the same, and it's a way of, you know, following along. I'm a student at Stanford, and I was at Stanford today. And I don't know how many of you know the Papua New Guinea, a sculpture garden they have there now. It's a really fantastic garden. And earlier in the day, I'd passed by the Rodin's Thinker that they have outside one of the libraries. And then in the sculpture garden, it seems that one of the artists from Papua New Guinea saw Rodin's sculpture of the Thinker on campus, and he said, "I can do better than that," and so he made his own Thinker. So now there's two Thinkers at Stanford. There's a French Thinker and there's a Papua New Guinea Thinker, and they have different, very different expressions. And in my years at Stanford, I've had this fantasy of having a third Thinker, or actually, I didn't know about this new second Thinker until today, but another Thinker on campus. Because the Rodin's Thinker is kind of in front of this long lawn. And I thought at the opposite end of this long lawn, I wanted to have an equal-sized statue, but not up on a kind of pillar, but actually down on the ground, of the Buddha sitting in meditation posture. And I thought it would be a really great contrast, Rodin's Thinker and the Buddha, you know, sitting there in meditation peacefully. And naively, a person might look at that and say, "Oh, this represents, you know, East and West. In the West, we're into cognitive thinking and, you know, figuring things out and programming and all the kind of things that we do so well right here in Silicon Valley. And in the East is about, you know, serenity and emptying the mind and being, you know, tranquil and all that." It's incredibly naive and simplistic to make that kind of East-West distinction. And perhaps rather we should look at just different sides of human capacity that these two sculptures represent. But they have a Rodin garden at Stanford. And I realized one day that Rodin has his Gates of Hell. If you've never seen it, you should go look at Rodin's Gates of Hell at Stanford. And at the top of the Gates of Hell is the Thinker. Have you noticed that? And I thought, that's where the Thinker is supposed to be. And the Thinker is looking down at hell, as far as I can tell. And I realized that the Thinker is not thinking about, you know, software programming or thinking about, you know, existential, you know, real, you know, philosophy. But Rodin's Thinker, I believe, now that I look at him, he looks tormented. And he's not, you know, it's not like the pinnacle of Western thought and philosophy, and, you know, it's rather the pinnacle of Western angst. Maybe I shouldn't talk about Western, but just the pinnacle of human angst, of someone who's maybe, now I imagine the guy's racked with guilt and shame and unworthiness and fear of the future and hell and damnation and consumed. He's kind of lost in himself. He's kind of hunched over, you know, he's sitting there and he's kind of lost in himself and unaware of the world around him. And I kind of see the statue and see someone who's kind of closed off in an inward kind of movement. And then the opposite, the Buddha, then, is someone, or that capacity we have within us, not to be closed off, but rather to be open, because the Buddha sits there with an open chest, which is something people usually don't look at when you see a Buddha statue. They maybe look at the serene face or the hands. But the Buddha statue sits there with an open chest, an exposed chest, the kind of chest that we don't allow to be exposed when we feel afraid or vulnerable, when we collapse in or we hide ourselves or something. And so it's a phenomenal kind of expression, I believe, of symbol of someone who's sitting open-hearted, open-chested, in the way that the Buddha is kind of to the world. And the Buddha sits with a certain kind of serenity, a certain kind of peace. But the image for me that's more important than peace is the image again of openness. It's the open-heartedness, it's the open-mindedness. Open-minded in the sense that the mind is not preoccupied with concerns, but rather is open to allow whatever it wants to engage in to come freely and go freely. As opposed to having a mind which is locked onto something, locked onto fear, locked onto memories, resentments, plannings, fantasies, shoulds and shouldn'ts. But rather a mind that is not locked that way, but a mind that where things can flow through in a creative way, in a free way, in a way that when we're locked, they can't. So I see these two statues as being kind of these two possibilities of each of us. The possibility of being kind of maybe cramped and constricted and full of existential angst, and the possibility of us being open, at peace with ourselves, at peace with our world, and free in our minds and free in our hearts. So that's what I thought of today. I don't know if it's a good idea or not. It was fair to kind of compare these statues, but one of these days I'm hoping to get a very wealthy benefactor, and we're going to get this very big, you know, Renaissance-size sculpture of the Buddha, and we're going to sneak in, you know, midnight into Stanford and plop it there on the lawn, and no one's going to know where it came from, and no one's going to dare to remove it, and there it is. We'll know. But you won't tell anyone, right? So, and then we can put a label on it that says thinker. So we have three thinkers at Stanford, three models of how it can be. So before I tell you any more about what mindfulness is and what you're about to do and all this stuff, why don't I teach you first about the posture. Mindfulness meditation can be done in any posture at all. And because mindfulness, very simply, is the capacity of the mind to pay attention, to attend to what's going on in our life, as opposed to being unconscious attention, being consumed or preoccupied with what's going on without really noticing carefully what's going on. When we do meditation, it's very useful to assume or take a posture that is a help for our ability to attend, to be present, to pay attention. We can pay attention to any posture, but some postures tend to be pragmatically more useful than others. Sitting on the floor is for most people is kind of a universally wonderful posture for paying attention, for being open, and for being relaxed and allow ourselves to kind of trust our posture, trust our body, and trust gravity. It's not necessary to sit on the floor. Sitting in a chair is also a wonderful posture. But sitting in a chair in a way that lets us be a little more open-chested, more open, rather than kind of collapsed in on the chair. So I want to take a little bit of time to talk about posture, and then we'll do a little practice before I've given you any real instructions. And then afterwards, I'll tell you what you did. How does that sound? So if you're going to sit on the floor, what you want to do is sit in a way that provides some stability. And one of the most stable ways of sitting is to make a tripod, to have three points to support you. And that's the cross-legged position. I recommend that to sit, especially for people who are relatively new, and to sit with both legs flat on the ground, one foot in front of the other. If they're crossed, which is often a good way of sitting. There's a tendency sometimes of that it kind of throws your body to one side. You know, you kind of relax and you're like this. And then to sit up straight, you have to kind of stretch one side more than the other, which becomes a yoga teacher's nightmare to kind of... And if you want to bring your foot up like this, then yoga teachers say you should alternate legs, so you stretch both sides equally. But having both feet flat on the ground is relatively symmetrical, and it's relatively balanced, and it's also more comfortable for most people because there's not as much torque on the knees or on the hips. But in order to get the knees down, it's very useful to sit on a cushion. And the most common thing to sit on is a round cushion. These are called zafus in Japanese. And when you sit up, then your knees tend to go down. And the way to sit on the round cushions is to sit not flat in the middle, but to sit on the front third of them, so that the slope of it tilts your hips forward slightly. Your pelvis kind of rotates forward slightly. And if your pelvis rotates forward, it's easier to get your knees down. Everybody can get their knees down if the cushion was high enough. However, gravity works against us because it gets too high, it becomes a slide, and we kind of slide right off. But some of you who can more or less get onto the floor might want to experiment sitting on on higher or lower cushions to see how comfortable you can get. So like you, you're sitting flat on the floor. If you sat up on a cushion, you look flexible enough that probably you could get both knees down. And it's a lot easier to sit for a long time if both knees are down. There are other ways of sitting. Some people like to sit on these half moons. They provide a different kind of support that some people prefer. And some people like to sit on benches, and like this. And the idea of a bench is you don't sit cross-legged, but you sit on your knees with this... kind of above your feet so that it takes your weight. And that's a nice way of sitting. It's not as stable as cross-legged, but for people who can't sit cross-legged or people who want to alternate, this is nice. The other option for cross-legged sitting is to take one of these round cushions and put it between your ankles and then sit straight down on top of it. And that works fairly well also. And Allison also, she sells these things and you can order them. She can provide them for you. And I think she's probably the cheapest price in the peninsula, so it's a good deal. And if you want to experiment afterwards with these, you can come up and try them out. So, so there's nothing particularly mystical about sitting cross-legged. It's just a very stable way of sitting. And having stability is very helpful. But the most important thing of sitting meditation is to have a straight spine, is to let your spine be alert and erect. And so you want to kind of sometimes when you sit down to kind of be careful and mindful as you sit down, to have a balanced, have your weight balanced on top of your sitting bones, and then to feel your spine, kind of feel up your spine, up your vertebrae to see if they're balanced, so you're not leaning forward or leaning back. And so the weight kind of goes through your spines and down into your sitting bones, and you sit in a balanced way. You can have your hands in any posture that's symmetrical, where they're both doing the same thing. And some people like to have them on their thighs or on their knees, up or down. The classic, the usual Buddhist way is to have your hands together. And that's kind of nice because there's a way which there's kind of a gathering of our body, or gathering of our energy into kind of this area around here, below our navel, which is a place that if we really relax, there's kind of a settling of things into this area, kind of a concentration of attention. If you have your hands all the way down on your ankles, like this, for some people will find that it tends to pull their shoulders forward. It depends a little bit on how long your arms are compared to your torso. And some people then will get something, like a little pillow or a towel or something, and put it on their ankles so that they can rest their hands a little bit higher. And that can be helpful for your shoulders sometimes. And the idea then is to continue the straightness of the spine up into the through the neck. And it can be useful to tuck the chin back and down slightly. And what's explained in some of the classic texts is that if you do that, it tends to control the wandering mind, though no one believes it. a different way of saying the same thing is, which is actually I think is maybe a nicer way of describing it, is to create a little bit of space between your last vertebrae and your skull. And in doing, you kind of open that area a little bit, so there's a little space, spaciousness. And that kind of does the same thing, I believe. And you do see, I think there's the tendency when people think a lot in meditation for their chin to go up and out. And we, in our tradition, we sit with our eyes closed. It's not necessary, but it's what our tradition does, and so, you know, it's good to do what the tradition says, but it's not required. Gently, softly close the eyes. The mouth is also closed, and the tongue is up against the roof of the mouth. If you're sitting in a chair, what you want to sit also in such a way that your back is well supported. And your back is better supported if your knees are lower than your hips. If your knees are higher than your hips, then it tends to kind of push your back backwards, the lower back, and then puts a strain there, and it's difficult to, you know, your back will grow out at some point. And so some people who have long legs might want to actually sit up on a cushion, maybe much like this. You want to sit in a way that's stable and kind of firm, and having the legs kind of go straight out and at right angles down, so they're parallel to each other, with the feet both flat on the ground and not crossed, tends to provide more stability. If it's possible, it's recommended you don't use the backrest if you sit in the chair. Some people need to use a backrest because of back conditions, so it's fine to use it if you need to. But the reason for encouraging people not to use it is that there's a wonderful and intimate connection between our inner psychology, inner psyche, or inner life, and what goes on in our body and our posture. And to the degree in which Buddhist practice is about becoming self-reliant in an inner psychic way, it's a lot easier to find that if we become self-reliant in our posture, not using a backrest. So just sit out away from the backrest if you can. If you need to use a backrest and you have a choice in the matter, then only using the backrest for your lower back is recommended. And maybe you take a towel or take something and put it into your lower back and really kind of push your back into that support as a way of getting some strength there, so the rest of your back is kind of pushed up and it's easier to keep upright. And the same thing with the hands. That can be any way that is more or less symmetrical. That's the basics of the posture. So why don't we, just take a comfortable, alert posture like this. And those of you who have had instruction before, forget all about what you've ever learned. Beginner's mind. And just notice, what is your experience of yourself right now? In whatever way, there's no right way or wrong way. What is your experience of yourself as you're sitting here? And the exercise is not to think about your experience, but rather to sit and sense or to feel from the inside, what is your experience of yourself? With a sense of curiosity or exploration, what is it to be a human being who's alive at this moment? And there's a big difference between having your experience and knowing what you're having, sensing and feeling it. There's a difference between thinking and then knowing, being aware that you're thinking. There's a big difference between being tired and being aware or feeling that you're being tired, sensing, knowing. There's a big difference between aching or struggling in your body and knowing that your body aches or itches. So continue for a few minutes, feeling and sensing whatever is happening, whatever presents itself to you as part of your experience. And your task is to hold it, contain whatever is happening in your conscious awareness. So in a simple way, you're present, noticing. Noticing the difference between getting caught up in something so you're no longer aware, and then simply being aware as if awareness was a container through which your experience goes. And then now, turn your attention to your breathing In order to do that, you can take a few deeper breaths so you can feel the connection to your breathing, to the way which your body experiences the process of breathing. And then, having done that, let yourself breathe normally, but maintain the connection with the breath. Let your attention, let your awareness explore what it feels like for the body to be breathing. And notice the tendency for the mind to wander off into preoccupations and concerns. And notice how that's different than simply resting in your breathing. And when your mind wanders away, just softly and gently, lovingly, let the attention, your awareness, settle in the body's experience of breathing. Feeling the expansion of the in-breath, the release or the contraction of the out-breath. So what mindfulness... mindfulness is a capacity that we all have. It's the capacity to be attentive. It's the capacity to be aware. The capacity to know what's going on. And that's a capacity which all of us have all the time. It's not something Eastern or mystical or unique. In order to function in life, it's constantly need to be aware of what's going on. However, what we're doing in mindfulness practice is cultivating and strengthening, developing this ability. So it becomes a much more present in our life than it usually is. And as we do that, it can have very powerful effects on our life. The movements of stress, the movements of psychological suffering that many of us struggle with, tend to be movements of preoccupations, tend to be movements where we're kind of caught in things without really bringing a clear mindfulness, a clear awareness of this is what's going on. And to the degree in which we can be aware of what's going on, we're not preoccupied by it. We're not caught by it as much. And so it brings into the situation a certain level of certainly awareness of what's going on, but also it could be very subtle, a kind of sometimes we use the word detachment, which is not the same thing as aloof, being aloof or non-attached, but it moves us a little bit from that preoccupation, being so tightly kind of caught up in what's going on. So what we're doing in mindfulness is slowly finding ways to strengthen our ability to bring careful attention, loving attention, to our life as it appears to us moment by moment. One of the cardinal themes or axioms of Buddhism is that that which human beings find most precious, most valuable of being human being, of being alive, is only available to us if we're in the present moment to experience it. And maybe you find arguments, or maybe you feel differently for yourself, but experiences of love, of friendship, of joy, don't really happen in the future and the past. As experiences, they can only happen in the present moment. To the degree in which we tend to kind of go off into the future or the past, we get preoccupied by them, to that degree, we limit the opportunities for joy and love and friendship and peace as present moment experiences for us. And there are very powerful forces within us that pull us out of the present moment. One of them is that for some people, the present moment is uncomfortable. For many reasons, it's uncomfortable. And so there's a kind of wanting to escape discomfort. And so we train our mind to be thinking about the future or fantasizing a lot or thinking about the past. And notice that we don't have to really be present. So we can deny, in a sense, our discomfort in the present moment. We're bored with our work. We're afraid of our relationship we're in. And so it's better to kind of not pay attention to it, because paying attention to it reminds you of the pain. So it's a powerful mechanism of avoidance or denial to check out, to not be in the present moment. Many of us are caught up in anxiety about shoulds and shouldn'ts, about expectations and about desires that kind of pull us very strongly out of the present moment, hoping to get something fulfilled or something prevented in the future. And what's remarkable, I think for many of us, it isn't that some of us think that our thoughts about the future or thoughts about the past or our fantasies are as real as what's happening in the present moment. For many of us, I think thoughts about the future and thoughts about the past are more real for some of us in the present moment. And that's why we often get caught up so much in our anxieties about what's going to happen in the future. But our plan, our ideas about the future are only thing they are expectations. They might or might not really happen. To be able to settle, to find an ability, and a strength of ability to come back and be here in the present moment allows us to connect with ourselves and allows us then to better, more fully connect to the world around us. And what you'll find, I believe, I trust, is that as you kind of follow and do a mindfulness practice, your strength of connectedness to the present, the strength of being connected to yourself and the world around you, as the present moment unfolds and develops, will get stronger and stronger, and the present moment will get richer and more pleasant, and not necessarily more pleasant, because there are unpleasant things as part of the present moment, but more satisfying, richer and more diverse. Once you start developing the capacity to bring attention, mindfulness, conscious awareness into the present moment, you'll find that there are levels and realms of consciousness available to you which are much richer and more diverse. Than what is possible to us when we're thinking about the future or fantasizing or thinking about the past, which is actually a very, very, very narrow band of our human capacity, where many of us, I think, spend most of our time lost in that kind of those kinds of thoughts and preoccupations. Mindfulness meditation or mindfulness practice is used for many people as a form of stress reduction. And one of the most powerful ways which has entered into American society is not in its Buddhist form, its Buddhist reincarnation, but rather in its pain and stress management reincarnation. Some of you might have read Jon Kabat-Zinn's book or have taken one of his stress reduction classes that's inspired by him. They teach them wonderful classes at El Camino Hospital and Redwood City Kaiser. And there's no hint that this practice originally came from Buddhism. And I think that's marvelous, because I think that the mindfulness practice has so much to offer. It's nice to be able to offer it in a way that the religion or the religious kind of aura or whatever that seems so foreign to people doesn't turn people off. Just it's available in a very secular way. And it helps in stress reduction in a number of ways. It helps because if we can kind of learn to be in the present moment, mindful of what's going on, to that degree, we're not caught up in our concerns as much. And if we're not caught up as much, then we tend to start unraveling the forces, the momentum of being stressed out or being preoccupied. But also, as we become more mindful, more aware, it helps our stress because we begin understanding and seeing the forces and motivations, the intentions, the reactions within us that tend to cause the stress in our life. And this is why mindfulness practice is sometimes called an insight practice, that brings insight and understanding to those forces that motivate us and to think and react and feel the way that we feel throughout our life. So it allows us to go deeper into kind of the undercurrents of what causes us to think and feel the way we do. As a spiritual practice, mindfulness, we would say, the Buddhists would say, goes deeper. Because as the forces of reactivity, as the forces of preoccupation begin to abate, then the natural wellsprings of wisdom and love that are within us, that are found within us, have a chance to begin to kind of bubble up. And this bubbling up of love and open-mindedness and open-heartedness, of this very deep sensitivity to life that's more than just stress-free, but is actually a deeper connectedness with life, is a spiritual connection to life, a spiritual dimension, when the mindfulness becomes very strong. When I teach mindfulness, I tend to play down, I think, the Buddhist side of it, because I like it to be available to people who might not be turned off by, you know, another religion. But you should know that I do also talk about Buddhism and talk about it in the Buddhist context. So I would like to ask you now. We sat for 10 minutes. first just very openly sitting with your experience, and then for a little bit longer, and then with your breathing. What was that like for some of you, especially those of you who are new? Was it difficult? Was it interesting? What did you notice happen to you? Yes?
This is the first time I've tried this. Uh-huh. First time I've done this. I kept thinking about scenes and movies.
So you had a lot of visions?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That often happens.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Great. So what else?
Or you're shy.
Yes.
I noticed that I have a lot more tension and pain in my body than I normally acknowledge or am aware of. And I also noticed that I went to a place that I do try to avoid a lot because it engenders fear. It's about getting deeper inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time I've tried to meditate with mindfulness. I can understand why. The reason I'm here is to learn not to avoid them. Try to learn.
Beautiful. And in the context of pain, both physical and also emotional, the simple act of bringing awareness is actually healing. And maybe you understand the principle in the sense, you know, in therapy, they sometimes say that 90% of good therapy is the fact that someone's paying attention to you, someone's listening. And so in some way it creates a kind of accepting space where you can say what's going on with you and be heard, tends to allow deeper understandings to arise, tends to release a lot of holding and fear and preoccupation. The same thing we can do for ourselves. If we just bring attention to what's going on within us, it begins that within us, our pains begin to process themselves, begin to unravel themselves, begin to open up in a way they couldn't if we keep avoiding them. When we keep avoiding them, it's like we put a stopper on them, and they don't have really a chance to kind of show themselves and for us to understand them and get the wisdom that's there and to let them unravel in the sense of loosening up. So it's very powerful to bring attention to our pains. And part of what this five-week course will be about is learning how not to avoid as you wish to learn. So who else? Yes?
I'd like to add on to what she just said. I very much felt the same as for me, the part to finally disconnect from thinking about everything else around the world or just about my life and where the world I was presently in my body, I did feel a lot more pain than I would normally feel. And it's almost like I didn't want to feel it, but it was very strong, in which when you finally rang the chime, I went, I need to do this probably for 2 hours if I would be fully in my body. But that's what I was experiencing.
Thank you. What else? It's not a test, and no one's getting graded.
I kept thinking about how hot it was in here. And why those windows aren't being opened.
No, we can open the windows. Please, if someone wants to open the windows sitting near them.
If someone doesn't want to, I'd be happy to. I don't know if it was just a certain level of relaxing. And since I've been coming here, which is a few months, when I really can turn off the world, I see those circles again. And then it'll make me feel like I'm on the beach.
Some people will find that with levels of calm and concentration, that certain patterns of light or patterns of colors or something often geometric, often circular, will kind of appear in front of their sight. A lot of people don't have it, but it's not uncommon. And what's important for a meditator is not to get too interested in those, not to get fascinated, not get preoccupied in that and studying that, because as soon as you get preoccupied with that, it interrupts the process of opening up your awareness and being present. Yes?
Yeah, because one thing I notice when I try to meditate, I finally, you know, my mind finally clears. I get goosebumps all over. And it's kind of neat, actually. But the problem is, I sort of make that the goal of meditating. Maybe I'm getting caught up in the same thing.
Yeah, unusual. Sometimes people have unusual sensations on the surface of their body as part of meditation. It often comes a certain level of calm or concentration. And again, we'll talk more about that next week, because next week we'll talk about the body. But the principle in mindfulness meditation is we're kind of interested in our experience, but we don't get interested in the sense of getting caught up in it. This is really great, and let me, you know, what can I do with it, or can I play with it, or can I kind of really indulge in it and really enjoy it really well? Or the idea is just to kind of let it be there and be aware of it without getting involved in it. What we want is an uninvolved awareness. One of the metaphors is often used for meditation is letting the awareness be like a mirror. And the mirror, objects in no way stick to the mirror. Rather, when something's in front of a mirror, it's there in the mirror. And when it's no longer there, the mirror is not thinking about this thing that was just there. Or the mirror is not anticipating what's going to come. Right? The mirror just... And so we're developing a mirror awareness, a mirror-like mind. So when fascinating, sometimes very interesting things happen. Sometimes very threatening things or painful things happen in meditation. And what we'll slowly learn is how to maintain this beautiful thing called a mirror awareness that doesn't stick to anything. And what we find is that ability for the mind to be a mirror is the place we find our freedom. The ability to be a mirror, the opposite of being a mirror is something that, you know, sticks to things, right? And a mirror doesn't stick to anything. And that's where our freedom is. And this is a very important principle in mindfulness meditation that I was going to wait till next week to say it, but in mindfulness meditation, the experience where the point of mindfulness practice is not a particular kind of experience. And maybe that's a kind of strange thing to say. You think, well, isn't mindfulness meditation about having an experience of calm or peace or joy or bliss or love or something? Maybe it is, or maybe it's not, but it's not an experience. Rather, it's the way in which we hold our experience, which is the point. And regardless of what the experience is, we want to learn a way to hold it in an open-handed way, like hold it as a mirror that doesn't grasp or doesn't push anything away. And the movement of grasping or pushing away in all its varied forms is the common experience of human life. Liking and not liking, pushing away, holding on, wanting things to be different. But rather to have a mind that's like a mirror that allows things to be as they are, allows for deeper wellsprings of wisdom and compassion to arise in us, allows for freedom to be there. So what we're trying to find is not an experience. As soon as you're looking for an experience, which is the experience for meditation, guess what? You've lost your mirror. You've gotten sticky. Right? So it's not about an experience. It's about how we hold the experience. It's not about getting rid of your headache, but rather how do you hold the headache? And you'll understand much better how this works as you do it. But your freedom is found, and a certain kind of joy and peace is found, not by getting rid of the headache, but by letting it be there in a spacious way, letting it be there without reacting to it or tightening up around it or contracting or hating it or whatever. And in the opposite way, with joy and bliss and all kinds of wonderful experiences, the tendency is to say, aha, I got it. You know, I'm a really hot meditator. I can't wait to show off. And maybe I'll get a medal and I'll go meet a meditation teacher. And, you know, I deserve it finally. And, you know, and I better remember how this is so I can get it next time. And you sit down next time and you huff and puff. And what exactly did I do? And I wore that one particular sweater and I was 2 hours after my meal. And maybe if I contort myself just the way I can get that joy again. The point is, when joy arises in sitting, it's the same thing, to hold it in a way that doesn't either push it away or hold on to it. So have this mirror mind is in some sense the development of the practice. Does that make sense? So some of you may be disappointed to hear this, because it's kind of like you can't, the way you hold your experience, how can that be important? Give me some good experience. Give me another high.
Yeah.
Yes?
Mine wasn't a fair test because I had a terrible stomachache and I kept thinking, I wish I had a tongue, I wish I had a tongue. And it was really, really one of those things. So then I thought, well, maybe if I can learn to be insightful enough, there's some way I can learn to control this. And so I, it's still there. I haven't known what to do when you do have to. I'm trying to understand.
Right. Very good. Well, that's what the mind—that's one of the things that mindfulness will teach, is how, when there is pain, how to hold it, how to allow it to be there, without adding any more suffering on top of it. I give the example in our newsletter that just came out. You can pick one of these up. It has a schedule of our events. But the famous parable of the double arrows, the two arrows that the Buddha gave. And the Buddha said to his students, if a man is struck by an arrow, is that painful? Does it hurt him? And his monks kind of look at him and say, yeah, that's painful. And then he says, well, if he gets struck by a second arrow, is that even more painful? And they said, yeah, that's two arrows is more painful than one. And the Buddha said, the first arrow is sometimes out of your control. You have a tummy ache, you have a headache, you break your leg, you get sick, you get old, you die, or whatever happens. Some degree, these things are out of our control. The second arrow is the arrow of the way in which we react to it. So if we're sitting here and our tummy aches, and we begin hating our stomach, there's a certain kind of pain of the contraction of hate, which is different than the raw pain of the stomach ache. It's bad enough to have a stomach ache, but to have the restlessness and the preoccupation and the concern and the planning and the self-pity and the self-criticism of why did I eat so much and why am I more careful and I've been trying to diet for years and why poor me? That's all adding the second arrow. So this ability to develop the mirror mind is the mind that allows things to be as they are, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, but adding the second arrow of reactivity. And that, the Buddhists say, is a very, very significant thing to discover. And that as this ability to have this mirror awareness becomes stronger and stronger, our ability to be free in the world becomes stronger also. And, American culture, maybe all human culture, has a tremendous amount of emphasis on avoiding discomfort. And on one hand, it's one of the blessings of living in our culture. We don't have to feel a lot of undue pain. We take pain medication or whatever. But it's also, in some ways, undoing, perhaps, of our culture, because we've gotten to be such experts at numbing out. Alcohol, drugs, sex, food, you name it, we do it. So we don't have to be present for what's really going on in our life. And so we live kind of actually removed from ourselves. And I meet so many people in my capacity as a meditation teacher who come to me and are surprised after doing some meditation how much they've been a stranger to themselves, because they're constantly occupying themselves in many, many activities, often self-help activities, and they're so busy with these things that they've never really gotten to know who they are. They never relaxed in a very simple way, let who they are reveal themselves to themselves. So we have all these, we have this blessing and curse in our society of all these abilities to numb out. I have this, sometimes in this beginning class, I bring this Charlie Brown cartoon where Charlie is talking to Linus and he says, oh, so you think my father doesn't know anything about repairing cars? Well, just the other day we were driving down the road and there was this terrible clanky sound coming out of the engine. And Linus said, oh, don't tell me. He stopped and fixed it. And Charlie said, no, He just turned the radio up louder. And that's often what we do, right? We find some way to turn the radio up louder. So mindfulness practice goes diametrically opposed to that. And it's great. Yes?
Why is it a mirror instead of like Teflon? As opposed to not speaking.
Well, these metaphors, you know, don't work too well. But maybe a Teflon mirror. It doesn't stick. But a mirror it somehow, in a kind of sense, it registers. A mirror is an obvious, honestly, registers or reflects or states or recognizes what's there. And this ability to honestly and completely recognize what's there is the ability we have with the knowing capacity of the mind. But the mirror doesn't stick. So this capacity to know in and of itself doesn't have to stick. But often we confuse the sticking with the knowing.
Teflon touches and the mirror doesn't touch. It just observes.
Okay. But mindfulness is actually very intimate. It's not actually separate. It's actually maybe like touching. Because it'd really be in full contact with our experience. It's not removed from our experience. It's not aloof. But anyway. Yes?
Is it possible to expand a little bit more on the sticking part? I'm having a hard time grasping and understanding what that sticking really means.
Well, if you have, for example, sitting here and you have knee pain. Now, pain in your knee is just a neutral experience in the universe, just pain. It's not no big deal. But if I start thinking about the pain and think, oh, maybe I have cancer, or maybe if I sit any longer, my leg is going to break, and then I'm going to need to amputate it, and I don't have insurance, and I better get insurance. And I can't afford insurance. Maybe I should get a job. And what kind of job should I get? And oh, poor me, I never get a good job. And oh, I'm so unworthy. And that's really sticky. or a friend of mine who he was a Zen student in the monastery, and when his knee hurt, he hurt his knee back by pushing at it. That's a very sticky reaction. It was so sticky, I ended up having to have knee surgery. There was a period in my own meditation practice where I, for some reason, decided that joy was a hindrance to my meditation. So joy, often as the meditation deepens, as it matures, some people have the experience of spontaneous feelings of great joy. So at some point it started happening to me. And I thought the joy was a hindrance, so I was pushing it away, holding at a distance, not allowing it to kind of bubble up until I got a headache. I mean, talk about dumb. But that's a stickiness. Judging the experience is a stickiness. And you're sitting here and you're following your breath, very simply, and you think, oh, my breath is kind of shallow and short. In California, we've learned to have a long, deep breath if you really want to be hip. So I don't seem to be hip enough. So I'm not a good California kind of new age person now, and oh, you know, I never can do it right, and what a bad person I am. Judgments like that are stickiness. So there's a whole, you know, infinite variety of forms in which we get caught up in the experience. Does that explain a little bit?
That's great, thank you.
There's a lot more. Yes.
So when you get to that stickiness, where do you go from there?
Okay. We'll take 5 weeks to really kind of... What I want to do this first week is to keep the practice really simple. And the focus for this first week is to sit with mindfulness of the breath, just to go back and be with the breath the best you can. And that does two things. To be aware of the breath, you need to be in the present moment. So it's cultivating a strength of ability to stay in the present, develop some concentration of being in the present to counteract the forces which want to take you away. The degree in which you can come into the present moment around something which is relatively neutral, the breath, to that degree, you're countering the forces that are sticky, that are getting preoccupied and reactive and getting wound up by other things. It'll still happen, but each time you come back to the breath, you're deconditioning yourself slightly from spinning out. And most of our lives, we never take the opportunity to kind of step back and decondition ourselves. And we can actually, you know, the winding up in the mind gets, you know, tighter and tighter and tighter. One of the ways in which meditation works is we finally leave ourselves alone. We don't add any more reaction to what's going on. We just come back to the breath in the most simple way. Don't judge how the meditation is. Don't judge what's going on. Let whatever happened to be there. Allow ourselves to wander away when that happens, but then come back to the breath. And leaving ourselves alone in such a simple, non-judgmental way allows the wound-upness to unwind. One image I have of meditation practice, it's pulling the plug from a full bathtub. And as long as you're aware of what's going on in the present moment, the bathtub is draining. But as soon as you lose your awareness of the present moment and get caught up in some kind of concern, you're winding it up again. So meditation is a process, it's a beautiful process of learning to leave ourselves alone. And so many of us, that's what our innermost selves is most asking for. Leave me alone. So just coming back to the breath is a training in leaving ourselves alone. Because when the breath is neutral, it's not kind of judging, it's not preoccupying, it's not planning, just very simple. And then over the weeks, we'll talk more about your very question. So try to keep it really simple. What I'd recommend for you, we'll sit now again to give you a better sense of how the instructions is. But what I'd encourage you to do, the way this class works best, is if you meditate once a day, for this course of these 5 weeks. And if you're relatively new or new to meditation, I would recommend you start with 15 minutes of meditation and find some time in the day when it's relatively quiet where you're not going to be disturbed. Most people find it's best to do it early in the morning before they get caught up in the day's concerns. And go to some place that, close your bedroom door or whatever it takes to be not disturbed. And sit for 15 minutes. And then each week of this 5 week course, add 5 minutes until you get to maybe 30 or 35 minutes. And then you can kind of keep it there, or if it feels like you want to continue, you can go to 40 or 45 minutes. But to really have a commitment and really learn and really get a good sense of your own personal experience of what it's like to try this, then will help a lot to understand how to integrate the next level of instructions. So we want to keep the first week really simple. Nothing needs to happen. You don't have to have some kind of wonderful experience. All you need to do is slow. Remember to come back to your breathing. So the basic instructions is to take an alert but comfortable upright posture. And then softly close your eyes. And then in the beginning of a period of meditation, it's often nice to take 2 or 3 deep breaths. And as you breathe out, to relax, to let go of the shoulders, your tension, your concerns. And then breathe normally. And then also at the beginning of a period of meditation, it's nice to scan through your body. And if there's any obvious place where you're holding or where there's tension, and you might be able to relax, let go of those areas. So for example, sometimes the forehead can be softened. Or the eyes. And the shoulders. And it's also nice to soften and relax the stomach. To let the stomach hang forward, hang out. And then simply, very simply, feel what it's like to have a body. Feel your bodily experience of sitting here. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing in whatever way the breath appears. And there is no right or wrong way to breathe. The point is to become aware of how your breath is experienced right now. And if you have trouble noticing or feeling your breath, you can place your hand on your belly, abdomen, and just feel perhaps the movement there. And notice how the in-breath is differently experienced than the out-breath. And sometimes a helpful idea is that of resting the awareness with the breath. So that as the waves of in-breath and out-breath move through the body, your attention is resting, surfing on those sensations, on those experiences. And if you find yourself caught up or lost in thought, that's fine. That's what minds tend to do. And even if 1,000 times your mind wanders away, all you need to do is, whenever you notice the mind is lost, is to carefully and softly reawaken your attention on the breath. Rest your awareness again on the sensations of breathing in and breathing out. Letting your mind become still, letting go of your concerns. Moment by moment, coming back to your breathing. Letting the simple experience of breath be your resting place. No need to be concerned about how well you're doing. As you breathe out, breathing out is kind of a letting go, remember to stay present, to rest with the full letting go of breathing out. Not forcing it, but rather being there for it. And then for one last minute, entrust yourself fully to the breathing. Let your resting in the breath be as continuous as possible for 1 minute. Mindfulness of breathing, concentrating carefully on the breath, is kind of a universal practice. Many spiritual traditions teach it. And even in Buddhism, there are schools of Buddhism where the only meditation practice a student will do is just simply meditating on the simple experience of breathing. And it's said that you can become enlightened simply meditating on the breath. So it's very, very significant, very useful. We expand the instructions beyond the breath, but I would encourage you to keep it really simple during this week. And if you've had the instructions in mindfulness practice before, the full set of it, and you're going along this course, start over again during this this course, and just keep this next week. Keep your meditation practice really simple. And just come back to the breath. Other things occur and other feelings. It's fine to feel whatever you're feeling, to have whatever thoughts you have. You don't have to criticize or judge them. Kind of have a mirror mind towards them in a sense. But then whenever you notice, whenever you remember, come back softly and rest with the breathing. Kind of maintaining the connection to the breath the best you can without straining. So the idea is resting there, but resting there as long as you can. Letting everything else kind of fall away or do whatever it wants to do. If there's one or two questions about what I've said so far or about this particular meditation instruction, we could take that. If... Yes?
I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been coming for a long time and it's kind of dawned on me yet when you said that half of therapy is listening and Dad's ability to listen to you is healing. And all it really is doing then is you're listening to your body, you're being the listener for yourself.
Right.
And it just kind of dawned on me.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very much what we're doing, and it's very powerful to do that, even though it's such a simple thing.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe it's so powerful. Yeah.
Is it better to just breathe in through the nose and out through the nose, or in through the nose and out through the mouth?
We usually say, keep your mouth closed and just breathe in and out through your nose. Different people will feel the breath in different places. Some people feel it the air passing through the nostrils. Some people will feel it more in their chest rising and falling. Some people feel their abdomen rising and falling. So wherever you feel it predominantly, where it's easy to feel it, just let your attention rest there. On that one place, kind of cultivate and sensitize yourself more to one place where you tend to feel the strongest. But your, in terms of your answer, it's best to keep the mouth closed and just go in and out through your nose. Yes?
So the meditation starts out with the breathing exercise. Does it go beyond that? After?
Yeah, come back next week.
Because sometimes when I'm meditating, sometimes breathing, concentrating on breathing kind of gets in the way sometimes.
It can.
So I can just go without it. But you're supposed to start with that.
Well, that's the usual way of starting. It's kind of the usual foundation. There are other foundations. So, some people, the breath is not a neutral place. They've had some kind of trauma in their life. You know, they fell into the pool, almost drowned when they were young, and the issue of breathing is for some reason, an issue. And so it's not so neutral. They get a little bit frightened when they pay attention to the breath. And then an alternative place as the kind of foundation is to do listening meditation, where you just you bring yourself into the present moment, just listening to the sounds around you, not reacting to any of them, just allowing them to come, whatever they are, pleasant or unpleasant, but just opening to the panoramic play of sounds as they appear. Unless you have an issue with the breath, I'd encourage you to stay with the breath. But that's another alternative. Yes?
How still should you try to stay? Because I find myself yawning and my head starting to move, kind of stretch my neck.
Yes, sit still.
So don't try not to move at all.
Yes. The stiller the body can become, the easier it is for the mind to become still. When you start moving the body, there's such a close relationship between the body and the mind that a lot of fidgeting and a lot of moving will actually agitate the mind, stir up the waters in a sense.
What if it's involuntary?
Then it's fine. If it's involuntary, it's fine. So sometimes a cough or a yawn or certain movements, you know, simply happen on their own. Then the practice is just to notice it. You know, that's fine. But, stretching like this, you know, oh my, you know, or itching, you know, and that's not, involuntary. That's, there's a lot of choice involved. Though some people don't realize that until 5 minutes later they've done it. You only have choice in the. We have a tremendous amount of choice in our life, but we only have choice if we notice the choice, the ability, and the part of the power where freedom comes from in the practice is we see more carefully where the choice lies. Yeah, but keep your body still.
Yeah.
The last one, then we should stop.
The distinction between paying attention to the breath and control of the breath. Something I have difficulty with. As soon as I start paying attention to the breath, I'm consciously breathing.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's a way of paying attention without controlling.
Well, there is, of course. And if you cannot control, that's nice. You'll be more comfortable. However, the beauty of mindfulness practice is, again, it doesn't matter what your experience is. What we're developing is our ability to notice what's happening. And so in terms of being with the breath, just notice the breath that you have. And if you're controlling your breath, become the world-class expert in a controlled breath. Just notice that. Oh, this is what a controlled breath feels like. Don't make a big deal out of it. So the last thing that, a couple of things I'd like to say to end. One is the basis for this teaching this kind of way is done on a donation basis, which means that we're continuing a tradition that this meditation practice is taught in Asia, taught traditionally in Buddhism, that we offer it as freely as we can to people so that anybody can do it, any kind of income, their finances, it doesn't get in the way. And also there's a feeling in Buddhism that this practice is in some ways priceless, and to put a price on it doesn't make any sense. So we don't charge. However, there are two baskets out in the hallway if you want to make a donation. One donation, one says, I think it says Sangha Dana. And Sangha means community. And that's to help pay for the expenses of putting on this kind of event. And primarily it goes, we have to pay rent to the Quakers for using this room. And the only way we're going to pay it is that if all of you help pay for it. And if each of you could donate $1 for the rent, for the Sangha Dana, that would cover whatever we, and the rent and other expenses we have. But that's a donation, it's up to you. The other thing, you just mentioned that what the Quakers have asked of us, because this is their sanctuary, is that we don't bring food or drink into this room. They have asked us for that, so we'd like to honor their request. The other basket is called, it says Teacher Dana, and that is if you want to make a donation to me. And it's completely voluntary. And the feeling there is that if you would like to support my ability to continue teaching, to be a teacher, this is your ability to offer the support to me. 95-99% of my livelihood comes from donations that I get for teaching meditation to people, which I do a lot of. And one way of thinking of it is that I can only continue doing this because I'm supported. If I wasn't supported, I'd have to get a regular job. That would be some, would be very different, less demanding, I think. And it's very interesting that we tried at Spirit Rock for a while to charge for these courses, and they charged, I think, $60 for a 6-week course. And what was very interesting was the dropout rate through the 6 weeks was a lot less when we charged than we didn't. And this is the same teaching. And it didn't matter who the teacher was. It's as if in our culture we respect or honor things that we pay for more than things that are offered for free, which says something about our values. A friend of mine had the same experience where he was teaching in a town, and this was in Australia. And hardly anybody came to his classes, and it was kind of wasn't really working. And then he switched from a donation system to a fee. And within a few months or 6 months, he was teaching 7 classes a week, and there were waiting lists for people. And it was the same teaching, right? So you might just keep that in the back of your mind. not so much about how much you donate.